Good evening. Shall we start? I want to welcome you to the fifth lecture of the Public Architecture Series, jointly sponsored by the Royal Academy and the Cities Program of the London School of Economics. My name is Saskia Sassen. I work here, or so they hope. And I will be introducing Norman briefly. Then Norman and I will have a discussion. This is a bit experimental. It's not like we have rehearsed this. We did this before once in Pontresina, so we're just taking a chance. There will be time for questions from the audience. The concern in this series on public architecture really is the intersection between the city and architecture. And we know, certainly from living in London, that the city and architecture shape each other. They fight each other. They inspire each other. And I would say that Norman is not only a great architect, but is also an enactor of that intersection through his work that is really at the cutting edge of this mix that is innovation, infrastructure, sustainability, urban design, and then the broader issues that concern the city. As someone who is interested in economic globalization, I cannot help but notice that Norman also does all of this globally. His office has about 500 partners. I don't know that this is the latest statistic, but you will correct me. And they work in offices around the world. Foster and partners have designed airports in Asia, government headquarters in Europe, and museums in the United States. Most importantly for us here, Norman has built our new library, which is now open. The books are not there yet, and admittedly, the value of a library has something to do with its books, but the library is open, and it is really a spectacular library. I can look into it from my office here at the LSE. Despite this prodigious range of architectural output, Foster's designs always possess extraordinary clarity and rigor, which I must say helps me, a non-architect, someone not particularly knowledgeable about architecture, but very interested in the city, and hopefully knowledgeable about the city, to understand and really engage in a dialogue with that which we call architecture. And I would say that this clarity and rigor apply both to his larger scale urban projects, which I think you will talk about tonight, but also to buildings and small scale objects, door handles, tables, light fittings. I would like to have some of those. No, that was not part of the text here. Over the last 30 years, Foster has designed some of the world's best-known architectural icons. Here I mention a few: the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, the Great Court of the British Museum, Stansted Airport, the Communications Tower in Barcelona, which is an enormous tower. It's named El Fosterito, which in Spanish means like little Foster. We infer that the big Foster is the man himself, but we don't know. The Reichstag in Berlin, where I must tell you, Norman, I just had to testify to the German parliament, which includes some barracudas who really were out to get me about globalization and its problems. And I felt enabled by that design, which provides room for people to look into the Reichstag. So to me, that was quite an interesting intersection with architecture. And my testimony went all right, too, which was even better. Norman's contribution to the field has been widely recognized. He has won the Pritzker Prize, the Riba Gold Medal, which are sort of the Oscars of architecture. He was awarded the Order of Merit and was made a life peer last year. In recent years, Norman and his practice have become involved in cities. In these new urban projects, he brings a unique passion and analytical rigor, which are of great significance to the problems of the contemporary city. This is why we have invited Norman tonight to address the interactions between cities and their infrastructures. There are few people better qualified to talk about this subject. Please join me in welcoming Norman. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Ricky came up with the title of Infrastructure and Cities. So in that spirit, I shall try and share some observations and some experience on the subject, starting with the first rather familiar image, which should come up. Help.
Okay, help coming.
I'm sure I pressed the right button. It's that
down to go
forward. Okay. I say a familiar image in the sense that both the bridge and the Opera House are emblematic symbols of Sydney as a city. And in one sense, they represent perhaps an earlier, very strong tradition of infrastructure, the bridge, the domain of engineers, the Opera House architecture, the domain of the architect. I think that those with other divisions we are seeing being eroded. Changes are taking place. The infrastructure which previously was uninhabited by humans, we are now seeing trends where it becomes inhabited. The domains of architecture and engineering are also being broken down as those traditional barriers themselves are broken down. So we're seeing the enlargement of multidisciplinary teams coming together, and that's, I think, one of the issues that hopefully we might have an opportunity to talk about on one of the projects that I'll be showing, which is the Elephant and Castle project. And Fred wonderfully is in the, Fred Manston in the audience here, the Chief Development Officer of Southwark, and my colleague John Prevett, who's very close to the project. So hopefully we might have an opportunity to explore some of those things in the context of a London project here when we have a dialogue. So in that sense, I hope that some of the things that I show will provoke a discussion on those subjects. I could go on about examples of the dissolution of these traditional barriers between building and infrastructure. An airport, for example, is it infrastructure or is it architecture? A stadium, is it engineering just to take spectators, or in its more developed form, if you take the old Wembley and the new Wembley, it embraces within its structure all the facilities for global communication. The spectators are only a small part of that performance, whereas not that long ago they were the dominant element within the stadium. The stadium embraces all kinds of other activities, hotels, offices, museums, almost a kind of mini hospital. So in that sense, the infrastructure becomes more inhabited. And this combination of infrastructure which take new forms and the buildings that they serve, my proposition is really very simple, and that is that the infrastructure of communication, whether it is physical and visible, the boulevards, the public spaces, the transportation, the linkages to get from one place to another, I would sustain that that which is the urban glue, whether it is visible or it is invisible, electronic, digital, it still has to touch down into the physical environment. And that infrastructure, in terms of its impact on the quality of our lives, is more important than the individual buildings. And if that sounds like a betrayal by an architect who's passionate about architecture, it isn't. It's just that I cannot see one without the other. And if I had to make a value judgment and say, which one do you really give the highest priority to, you give it to the infrastructure, because that more directly influences the quality of the way in which we experience cities, whether we're visitors or whether we live in them, whether we work in them, very, very directly. And that combination of the infrastructure and the buildings has very direct influence, not only on the quality of the environment, but you could argue in terms of energy and issues of ecology and pollution, right to the core of survival. Because if, in terms of an industrialized society, buildings consume 50% of the energy, then the remaining 50% is divided between transport and industry. And as we see rapid population growth and urbanization, then it's got a mind of its own, this. I must treat it more gently. I think that's the lesson. So we're seeing the growth on an unprecedented scale. It's estimated something like by 2030 that two-thirds of the world will live in cities, megacities, some of them around the Pacific Rim, of 45 million. A suburb of Mexico City, Chalco, for example, is the size of a European city at more than 3 million. And yet, Chalco has no infrastructure. And by that, it has no paved roads, it has no sewage, it has no electricity, no power, no running water. So so it really repeats the that point about the relationship between quality of life and infrastructure. And it follows, I believe, that one of the key challenges that that it presents is the quest for equating high quality environment with higher density and sensitivity to issues of energy and pollution, mindful of the point that I made earlier. The relationship between the infrastructure and public spaces, old and new, and the mixture of uses in terms of the combination of the workplace and the place to live and the leisure components of society. And obviously, in terms of renewal, growth, and regeneration. So those are really the themes. Urban sprawl is highly political, even in America. And if you take the image of Greater Chicago, then over the period of 1970 to 90, a 4% increase in the population has been reflected in a 50% increase in land consumption. And one could, I don't believe that there is an ideal form of a city. That would be far too much of a generalization. So I'm not suggesting that the North American model with its uncontrolled sprawl, and there's a very strong political backlash against that, which is enormously strong and cuts across social barriers, economic barriers, and party political divisions. I'm not making a plea for an Asian model, a North American model, or a European model. But in passing, if you compare as one of the barometers of energy, and there are many that you can take, one is the consumption of land by road networks, the social implications of the depletion of the inner city as the annular ring of a sprawling city moves ever increasingly outwards and creates a social vacuum in its heart. But if you just take one barometer of energy consumption, which is gasoline, and you compare two cities of very similar population, very similar climates, Detroit and Copenhagen, then one which is the compact European model, much more of an emphasis on the ability for a close-knit community, the ability to be able to use cycles, high-quality public transport, the consumption is nearly 10 times energy measured in gasoline between those two examples. And the point about the quality of the environment and its relation to high density, I think it's commonly assumed that by many people, politically, political leaders, that the higher density equates to a poorer environment. And yet, if you compare the most affluent groups in society with some of the poorest, they do share equally high densities. If you take Monte Carlo, for example, and you compare it with Macau, they're both very, very high density cities. And there is a very strong relationship between density and consumption of energy. The denser the city, the point has been made statistically, the lower the energy consumption. If you take a city like Hong Kong, which also fits into that high density pattern, then you can start to see that there are two levels of use in Hong Kong. There is the lower ground level, and then an extraordinary number of buildings are knitted together by an upper level walkway system. So you can move from hotel to bank to shopping to cinema without ever touching that lower level. And one of the projects that we did, which was a research project with Obayashi in Japan, which was an ultra-high tower at something like 800 meters high, with a population on the right-hand side there of some 55,000, and a mixed use so that all the movement would be internal. There would be no highway distribution systems. This would be built offshore, very, very close to the shore in Japan, and one of a number of exploratory models in terms of new urban forms. And in one sense, to describe that at the time, we referred to it as kind of vertical Ginza. But that Ginza could have been Hong Kong, and taking Hong Kong, the map of a diagram of Hong Kong here, these are all those bridges that I referred to that connect the individual buildings. So in one sense, if you take this and you turn it through 90 degrees, then simplistically, you end up with that in terms of its ability to provide very high levels of density with very low amount of land use. But Hong Kong is also very much about the ground level experience. And one of the challenges, as we saw it, with the replacement of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank 30s style in the 80s with a new building was to question this kind of colonial model of a bank. It's really quite hostile, very private, and like any other banking hall at the time in Hong Kong, you would go and it would actually block that part of the city. Very, very dense statue square fronting it, one of the few open spaces in this very dense community. So to make this building permeable, it was lifted up and a route generated through it. And this and a number of other examples, particularly our work in France and Germany, have led to really some of our later work here in London. And this diagram of the Thames here and the South Bank, Waterloo, Elephant and Castle, which I mentioned earlier, Parliament Square, Trafalgar Square. This is the so-called World Squares area. The British Museum, and to the north, the British Library, St. Pancras and King's Cross. And some of the linkages, exploring the ways in which connections could be made, improved, built upon, and some of those experiences made more permeable. I'm going to give a glimpse of that in terms of the World Squares project, which is this area here. You see Westminster, Trafalgar Square up here, Horse Guards Parade, St. James's Park. That is the study area, and the aims of that was to improve the setting of the historic buildings, improve public transport, and a fairly long brief, which we tried to summarize with my little kind of doodle of this guy doing the balancing act and making the point that really cities are always as living organisms trying to adjust themselves, trying to rebalance, to improve access but be mindful of security, to respect the demands of private cars but also public transport, the many visitors as against the Londoners, the ceremonial, the everyday, people standing still, people moving, local needs, wider needs, clutter, legibility, old and new. And giving some glimpses into that study, which is continuing and is rooted in the enormous amount of research. I mean, tremendous analysis, collection of data, the largest survey in terms of pedestrian movements through 169 observation points, working with a university-based group who moved out into the consulting world, a group called Space Syntex, and also this multidisciplinary group with traffic engineers, interviewing something like 27,000 motorists. And just one of the highlights was that the brief four world squares made the assumption that 60% of the people in the area would be visitors and 40% would be local. It was almost exactly the opposite relationship. Over 180 organizations were consulted, thousands of leaflets, public exhibitions. And interestingly, across that, 80% supporting change in the area, including local residents. If I give a glimpse into that process, Trafalgar Square, very familiar space. But when you actually come down to the ground and you see how that space is used, then really quite extraordinary contrast. I mean, if I go back to the aerial image, this side of Trafalgar Square, the north side, but this pavement is empty and deserted. It's absolutely packed on the top. So it's again that balancing act in terms of making value judgment based on the research of how the quality of that space and its linkages could be dramatically improved. And here you see the side immediately next to the National Gallery. And if you observe, note that it's so dense here that people literally jump up onto the grass and wear it. This is one of the team taking his life into his hands, crossing the road there. We came to some interesting sort of analysis about Trafalgar Square, and this makes the point that it's essentially dead, and certainly one part of it. And the kind of extraordinary prison-like experiences as you try to get across from one side to another. We're so used at the time that we were doing this project to, for almost anything that we were doing, of having to go down the road to Heathrow and sort of get on a long-haul jet, that we found ourselves. The World Squares project started with my interest in some of the issues of the city and decision to bring a group of people together every Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock for a kind of working breakfast, just to sort of share experiences. And then the competition came along and we decided it was natural to do it. One of these Tuesday mornings, somebody came up and they showed this this diagram here. It was one of the Space Syntex people. And they explained that all these were tourists, you see, in here, except for these yellow blobs. I'm a little suspicious of this, but the yellow blobs are people wearing suits. And they concluded that anybody wearing a suit was obviously working in London rather than sort of enjoying it. But the other thing that we also started to quiz ourselves about was why all these green lines going to this island here, and some across here. And you saw one of the team sort of making one of those lines earlier. We couldn't understand this and realized that really the site was that close. So we all kind of hopped into a minivan and made the crossing, and there's the team there on that island finding out why people would go there. And it's quite interesting, this, I mean, the one thing that this, one of many things this study did for us was that it got us actually using a city that we had taken for granted because we'd lived, worked there for so long, but we'd never used it in the way that visitors might use it. And the reason why everybody really wanted to get there was very, very simple, and that is that Trafalgar Square itself is inward looking. Once you get to that particular point, it's the perfect point at which to view all the vistas and take all the best photographs of London. And that was quite interesting in the way that it in turn informed the proposals for Trafalgar Square and a southern extension, to take that particular point, to embrace it as part of a wider Trafalgar Square, which would have diagonal entry and central entry. So here in this series of montages, original photograph, this is how it is now. And this is how, when we get greater permeability, and again coming to that point of improving the setting for the historic buildings, what you're not seeing here, but possibly on the next image, is also the access and the convenience, which you can measure tangibly, because it actually takes a very, very long time as a pedestrian to make that sort of circumnavigation. And so by closing that north side to traffic and opening up the corners of the space, you get a very dramatic transformation. It's quite interesting to see some of the new urban vistas that are opened up in terms of the historic church here. So as always, we can see the before and after. And despite a certain potential embarrassment, we, as a team working together, would follow people from the tube stations and see how far they went north from Trafalgar Square and how far they go south, sorry, from Parliament Square north and from Trafalgar Square south. And eventually they never made the connection between the two. They kind of gave up somewhere along the way. And that led, amongst other things, to respond to that by, again, redistributing the space along Whitehall, improving the access to the cenotaph, and improving the pedestrian experience, the pavement, the detailing, and providing the occasional kind of watering hole along the way. And if we think of Whitehall as making that connection, then the one very gentle intervention on this side to extend the pedestrian domain again has the power to transform. It's quite interesting, but change at any point is has its political dimension. And I'm reminded of a few years back when, through the Architecture Foundation, a series of debates on London, and inviting one of our clients, Pasqual Maragall, the mayor of Barcelona, here to share his experiences as a mayor. And I think that that in turn was one of a number of influences that have eventually led to the creation of a continental style mayor here in Europe. And was also this debate quite influential in the sense that the idea of taking the cars out of Horse Guards, I promoted that at this and other opportunities, and that was taken up politically. And it's interesting now. I think a lot of people who experience this space would find it hard perhaps to remember or even imagine that not that long ago it was arguably one of the biggest open-air car parks in Europe. So again, quite interesting transformations. And here, work progressing on the World Squares project, Trafalgar Square, as it will eventually be in around spring Easter in 2003 on the present program. And the so in a way, the studies of infrastructure moving from the very, very large pattern. So this is, as you can see, the Thames here. This is the space syntax map of connectivity in terms of greater London itself. So working from the large scale and also working out from the very small tactile individual observing and those two scales coming together. And within that context, it's interesting to to challenge some of the mental preconceptions about parts of London and the way in which the railway system and its viaducts, also the similar quality of a viaduct in Elephant and Castle, that one tends mentally to think of this quarter of London as being, as it were, sort of South London. It's not really, it's geographically, it's physically part of that, I mean, central core of London. It's just that really, by virtue of historically, the better physical connections north of the river have left those other satellites, which are identified there, relatively historically deprived. And Elephant and Castle is quite interesting in that it is one of those kind of nodal points. It's unusual in the sense that it is a kind of city within a city. It is a community, as opposed, I'm not suggesting that there aren't people living in Vauxhall, London Bridge or Waterloo, but essentially these are more cultural or commercial areas, more focused in that respect, and less rounded. The site of the Elephant and Castle project is more precisely defined here, a 200-acre site, and very, very interesting connections with those other nodal points on the opposite side of the river. If you take those in terms of bicycle rides, then you're talking probably about 10 minutes. If you're thinking about trains, probably 5 minutes. Cars, well, depending on the traffic, I guess anybody's guess. But it's quite interesting that the perception, the mental perception of Elephant and Castle is that it is a kind of south, and yet actually it's further north than Victoria. And if we examine it in terms of its cultural setting and the changes which are taking place around the South Bank, then that, all those elements of change, gives a particular special dimension to urban regeneration in that area. The road and rail links are exceptionally good, notwithstanding the divisive nature of the strength is also the weakness. The connectivity in terms of the roads and the railways also has its downside in terms of the physical form that some of them have at the moment, and the way in which those need to transform in such a way to be shaped, to be moved, to be manipulated, such a way that they are better coordinated, they serve better, they provide the communication, but they don't socially divide. And here, if we look at the Elephant and Castle, you can start to see the way in which the road system is a dividing barrier, so that the east and west is blocked by roads, is blocked by the shopping centre, and in turn is blocked by the railway, which is elevated as a viaduct and becomes quite a strong barrier. And here we see that north-south road system, we see the northern road here, we see moving to the north here, the shopping centre, and to the south here, the elevated railway, the viaduct. All the facilities in terms of underground, overground, buses, they're all there, but they never really connect together. They never interrelate. Interestingly, in terms of historic buildings, Imperial War Museum, Tabernacle, the institutions, very, very strong generators in the area. And very difficult in the context of a relatively short talk to convey the amount of work in a relatively short period of time. I think we're talking this project over a two-year period so far in terms of its being set up. And all of the images that one shows of anything, it's important to remind ourselves that nothing happens by accident. There is no such thing as no design. It doesn't matter whether it's a building, a road, a railway, a bench, a bus stop, a sign. The list is endless. It has all been designed. Somebody has designed it. Somebody's sanctioned it, approved it, somebody's built it, and then it's there to be used. It's in the public domain. So there's no such thing as no design. Nothing happens by accident. It can be adequate or inadequate. It can be good, bad, indifferent. But it is consciously designed. And the quality of that is about attitude. It's not about cost. Quality is an attitude of mind. So if we're talking about this project or any project, then that starts with the client, whoever that client is, the commissioning body. So it's very, very important to identify those elements, whether it's a council, whether it's the elephant links, the ginger groups, the pressure groups, the local groups, the community itself. The community can be the housing estate. Collectively, it can be the individuals who comprise those, and the team of which we as architects were one of 30 consultants, one of five architects, and in that sense, sharing the responsibility for the master plan, which in a kind of ambassadorial way, I'm trying to give a few insights here, but that multidisciplinary team from many, many different quarters, all working together and trying to create the place to improve, mindful of these slightly different colors here, the leadership in terms of urban partnerships, the commercial investment side, and then the physical elements that will compose that, the infrastructure, community regeneration, sports, leisure, new housing, refurbished social housing, and the quest in terms of quality, that when this is complete, you will not be able to visually identify those different kinds of housing. It will be impossible. You will not be able to see which is the subsidized, the affordable, the private, the regenerated. The only distinctions will be between those parts which have been retained and improved rather than removed, demolished, and replaced. And that that process of consultation for our team was very important in the sense that I think we started like all of our competitors, and there were 30 of us originally competing, and then it came down to a kind of smaller group of three, and eventually we surfaced. I'd like to think that one of the reasons why we eventually did win this competition was that we really took the consultation process very, very seriously. And the only estate through this process, the Haygate estate, is the one that would be demolished and that would be replaced. The others would, for very important reasons, be retained. Now, it's interesting, but our starting point, our preconception, was that this is all 60s housing, it's high-rise stuff, everybody will be glad to see the back of it, and it's an opportunity for total renewal. That was certainly true of Haygate, as John will explain if we have the opportunity later. The residents of Haygate did not want their buildings to remain. Half of them wanted to be on that particular site, and the other half wanted to be within the borough. But they wanted to be in lower buildings, different buildings, not higher than six stories. Interestingly, to the contrary of our preconceptions, and I suspect everybody else who was working on this competition, communities, the rest, such as Draper House here, 24 stories, Perinet, some 12 stories, they felt that they would love to see an improvement in the setting of the buildings. In other words, the infrastructure within which these individual buildings were placed. They would love to see improvements in the bathrooms, kitchens. In other words, the physical infrastructure of their buildings. But they felt that they were very strong communities. They were opposed to the idea that these buildings would be demolished and replaced. And that is very much respected and integrated within within the very preliminary proposals which form the competition submission. And one of the proposals moving out from the Elephant and Castle Core here was that all the main roads would be landscaped, tree-lined boulevards to connect with the rest of London. Very important, strong, environmental, symbolic, urban gesture. Very ambitious program, 1,200 new social homes, 3,000 social homes to be refurbished, 3,500 new homes for sale, nearly 1 million square feet of live, work, and key accommodation, major transport interchange, enlarged shopping, something like 1.25 million square feet of shopping and leisure, 500,000 square feet of offices, hotel, community facilities, new public square on a very ambitious scale, and a tremendous amount of new green space. And in this process, to challenge a lot of the preconceptions of, for example, shopping. The idea of the large shopping centre is that it's a box, and it has a kind of asphalt roof, and it sits on the ground, and it has blank walls. That's probably a pretty good word picture of a large shopping centre. But here is the shopping centre. The shopping centre has the road that went through here, has the road underneath it. So the road is no longer the barrier. The shopping has alongside it workshops, other shops, roads, housing, and the roof of the shopping complex is in turn a green park. And if we look at a little comparison, we can total aerial view. This is the transport, new style transport interchange, which brings all those separate threads all together, literally under one roof. This is the main public space, which at the moment is the road through here. And this barrier of the railway is built over. So here you can see that very direct comparison, and the existing road re-diverted on this line underneath the shopping. You can also see those elements which have been retained and in quite important positions. So Draper House, that tall 60s building, and the quest that its setting be improved. Here you can see that at the head of this space here. And likewise, we can see Perrinet House, which is here. So very much woven into the larger new complex. Self-explanatory in terms of giving it a heart, breaking down those barriers, improving the setting. Very, very diagrammatic model here, but noting that the existing tabernacle is woven into that, the 60s housing, possibility of cultural centre, housing, towers, the transport now all knitted into that, hotel locked into it, and green space and the barriers removed. And here you can see the kind of before, the isolated train station here, and the potential for that interchange that knits together all those different modes of transport. And very much building on the pattern of the existing Walworth Road retail, creating green links into it and adding to it here. The orientation is slightly difficult here. The two roads that you can see there are these two roads here. And high-rise housing, which does make this, a lot of these goals achievable. And quite interesting, the extraordinary views with its proximity to the river and the very heart of London, that
that those towers would enjoy. Westminster slightly off the frame here, the wheel, and right across to Canary Wharf. Continuing that that pattern of linkage and the quest to relate the old and the new, to regenerate historic building and to create public spaces which will work both within a museum and also outside of museum hours. The British Museum, extraordinary magnetic attraction and capacity on a par with the Metropolitan in New York and the Louvre in terms of 6 million plus visitors every year. And not hitherto an entirely agreeable experience for something that was designed in the middle of the 19th century for an audience of which you could measure in hundreds rather than millions. So consequently, this is a bit like Trafalgar Square is at the moment. If you want to get to one of these galleries, you're pushing and shoving your way through another gallery to eventually get there. And a very, very solid heart to that building. Only when you see it from above do you see the relationship of the Great Library, which embedded in the fabric of storage buildings which have always surrounded it. A building which never had any facades, was never intended as a building, it was always to be buried in this kind of mass of storage. And I think that it's very difficult to imagine that this library was built 7 years after the original building. And originally there was a garden in the heart of the British Museum. And that was part of the inspiration for the our proposed master plan, of which there are seven separate components. The Great Court itself is one of those seven. One of them was to take the cars out of the main forecourt here, various other projects along the way. So I'm only going to talk about the Great Court itself. But here you can see from this computer-generated image in the early stages of the design process, the concept of taking away those lesser storage support buildings around the library and cladding the library and putting this glass bubble of a roof of extraordinary dimensions, and to make this the most minimal intervention, then only way of doing that, working over quite a number of years with the engineers, Bureau Happel, on this, very, very, very strong arch effect, quite voluptuous forms, very complex form, the ability to render this as something essentially minimal and simple was a tremendous challenge, because the library itself is asymmetrically placed in the space. And this shot taken in winter, very, very different now with higher angles of sun which are penetrating much more deeply into the space, will be a monumental sculpture on axis here, and very conscious decisions that although the inevitable retail and shopping was an important part of the experience, that it would not be an in-your-face part of the experience. It would be something as in the city itself, in a public space, which this is. It is deliberately ambiguous in the sense that it is a public space which works outside of museum hours, as well as enabling you to come in and then redistribute directly into the galleries themselves, both at the lower level and also at the upper level. And as you move around and you discover, just like the city itself, some of the spaces are very tight, some are open, very, very grand. So you do get those contradictory qualities of expansion and compression and discovery. The reading room itself refurbished so that again, for the first time, these are windows, these are buildings in space. You can see beyond. It's about permeability, seeing the sky, seeing a view beyond. It's an analog experience, the opposite of the digital in that sense. So orientation being really, really very important in this space. And the point about us, you walk up and you discover, you eventually discover the restaurant, which is also related to the entry to the upper galleries, the Northern Gallery block.
The British Museum would not have been possible without our work on the Reichstag. And I'm only going to show really two aspects of this building. And that is it's the way in which the public space, importantly, is woven into the transformation of this historic building, which was symbolically wrapped by Christo just before work started on its transformation. And this was an extraordinary creative act in itself, which was wonderfully, warmly received by Berliners following, I think, 20 years controversy, which led up to its eventual realization as a kind of installation, but it's also a kind of symbolic purging of the building. And so it's the public dimension and the ecological dimension that I'm going to touch on. And that transformation of the historic building into a new parliament moved from Bonn to be a parliament for the reunified Germany. Important to mark that on the skyline. And this structure here, this lantern, which works as a public viewing platform. So it receives many visitors, but it's also an important part of the ecology of the building and the kind of energy manifesto that is behind the project.
And this diagram makes the point that this lantern is a conical mirror, and that mirror reflects horizon light deep down, many stories into the heart of the building. The shade itself, which is driven by photovoltaic cells, largely symbolic, very small part of the energy story, but that drives this shade, which protects takes away the solar heat, except in winter, when it can be powered aside and it can let direct shafts of sunlight deep into the parliamentary space itself, the chamber, symbolically the most important space, and immediately below that.
When Parliament is in session, then that, as the previous image shows, it acts like a beacon which symbolizes the process of democracy. And so that it's illuminated on the skyline.
This is a mini power station. It develops energy for its own quarter, for the buildings around it, as well as serving its own needs. And it does that in quite a revolutionary way. It is not dependent on fossil fuels, for example. The form of energy is totally renewable. It is vegetable oil from sunflower seeds or rape seeds, or it could be palm if it was another part of the world or imported. And that is used as a very clean power source to drive a generator. And the waste heat from the generators is converted into cooling. And the cooling is moved around in the historic building in the form of chilled water in very, very thin pipes embedded in the fabric of the building, so you don't have any expensive movement of treated air. The ventilation air is relatively small. During the summer, it produces more energy than is needed, and that is dropped deep down to existing underground lakes, aquifers. Some are deep, some are not so deep, and then that is recovered as a thermal source in winter. And if we consider that
that ozone pollution is directly related to energy consumption, because that energy is almost entirely produced in a very dirty manner, then
it's interesting to make a comparison between the building at the time of the Cristo wrapping,
when just before that it was, in terms of its energy produced, consumed, and its production, depositing something like 10,000 tons of carbon dioxide annually into the atmosphere. And through these systems, that has been brought down to a mere 400 tons, which is a 96% improvement.
Just a glimpse into the background development, and if you
just a glimpse in terms of some of the modeling techniques, it's very, very, there's a kind of popular and very erroneous impression that in a way it's all about sort of people in white smocks pressing computers, and that there's no kind of touch with those things that you cannot measure or quantify. And that life would be very easy if everything could be quantified and measured. But some things wonderfully can't, and that is the quality of light, for example.
So that was explored in a 1 to 20 full size model of the assembly chamber and the cupola, the lantern, and there we are inside that 1 to 20 model. You can see the tip of the mirror. You can see in model terms here the press lobby, which looks down into the assembly chamber, the tribunes for the public there.
And if we look at the real-life full-size thing, we can start to see that ecological mirror. We can see the spiral ramp, which is part of the public experience. This is also a public plaza, and maybe difficult to see, but here is the kind of glass floor through which you can look directly down into the chamber below. All kinds of symbolic asides on this. You can argue that public society is above the politicians, who are answerable to them, and the extract system, which takes all the hot air out here of the chamber, is again part of the ecology of the building. And if you remember the tip of that in the 1 to 20 full size, the press lobby here, a very radical part of the brief that we brought to the project, the idea that there would be one common press lobby, that those activities would not take place in another building remote, but they would be knitted, integrated into the fabric of the building itself.
And here you can see the assembly chamber, the public tribunes. This is taken in winter. The solar shield is powered away. The shaft of sunlight comes in to warm this space, to give it that sort of poetic dimension, to bring it to life. You can see the permeability, the transparency, the symbolic importance of being able to look from the west right through the building to the east. The original Berlin Wall came hard up against the eastern side of the Reichstag. So symbolically very important. For the first time in the history of the German parliament, this was not a building with solid walls. This is a building that you literally could look through. Also commissioned works of art in the West Lobby and elsewhere. And if we come to the final image, which where you can see that spiral ramp, two ramps interwoven one in the other. So it's a continuous flow of movement. Each one of these is a one-way system, woven one inside the other. That's the glass floor, which you can look down and which visually connects and brings together that infrastructure, the infrastructure of the public space, the movement. Is it old? Is it new? Is it infrastructure? Is it architecture? I think that's an interesting question. The only thing one can say with certainty is it's incredibly popular, and something like 3.5 million people visit it every year, despite the fact that there are very long queues and very little hours within the day in which to see it. Thank you. Can we switch it off? With a plug.
Norman, oops, I'm trying to create a bit of... Thank you very much. This was splendid. Let me just start the discussion by coming back to one of the first comments you made, which I thought was really quite extraordinary, both by itself and, of course, coming from an architect, which is this notion that the infrastructures of communication, the glue of the city, are enormously important. And my question or my comment has two parts to it. One is an issue of scales and technology, and the other one has to do with social issues. Scale and technology, is it the case that in this particular period where we have globalization, digitalization, these new types of communication technologies, the city emerges as a strategic site for all kinds of processes? As a political economist, I find that in this particular period, which I see starting about 20 years ago, the city indeed emerges precisely in the context of a global digitalized economic system as one of the strategic sites, partly because that's where that economic system hits the ground. I loved your image also of it always has to hit the ground. But then also for other more substantive reasons of scale, into which I don't want to go into now. But I wonder whether you find, as an architect so interested and knowledgeable about these technical issues, that the city is a particularly engaging site today compared to maybe 20 years ago. It's just a question, partly because of the complexities of the city, the challenges, these issues of traffic, the issues of pollution, etc. The second issue, not unconnected, but coming from a different angle, is the social issue. The data very clearly are showing growing income inequality, which partly at least inscribes itself in the urban landscape and produces spatial polarizations. Can this kind of optic that you have on the question of the space of the city and these issues of technology, communication, infrastructures, etc., engage those types of issues? Somewhere in your talk you mentioned raising the fluidity of connections between systems that right now are communicating, etc. Is there also in that project, which is a technical communication infrastructure project, a broader social project that gets enacted, at least partly, or is it simply totally separate? Well, not totally, but quite separate.
I think one is...
speak a bit in the...
Shall I switch this off? Is that a good idea?
It's
okay. I think that the city is probably working at its best when there is a synchronization between the those issues that you describe as technological and the social issues. In other words, we all feel good if we go on a great train ride. We feel mad as hell if it's a lousy train that breaks down and we have to wait forever for it never to arrive. So it is about quality, it is about service. And what is the equivalent of the incredible convenience of a discreet mobile phone, which connects us when we want to be connected and we can switch it off and we don't have to be connected? It's incredible convenience. Maybe it is the potential transformation in city terms of, for example, the promise of an integrated transport interchange in the Elephant and Castle, which doesn't intrude. It's there, we can get to it easily, we can link through all those different elements, we can get from the train onto our bike or whatever, and it's discrete. It's not dividing the community. It's where it needs to be, out of sight, out of mind, but it's serving us. So in that sense, I think the challenge is for the technology to be the servant and the social servant to make possible the quality of lifestyle, which is the... But I'd be much more interested to hear
people like Fred, John, others on
Those
issues, yes. Fred, say something.
I didn't really come to speak. I'm Fred Manson, and I work for the London Borough of Southwark. And in a way, we're your client, Norman, for this project. You have about 3,000 clients on it, and it's a pretty interesting thing, and most of those live on the estate. The Elephant and Castle is a tremendous potential, and I think it does bring together the question that you were asking about for both technology and for social issues. If either of those is not succeeding, we have not succeeded. But I like your comment about the Elephant and Castle being invisible, in a sense, when you use it as a transport interchange, because that's very important. Transport is, by its nature, people getting from one place to another. And that's one of the uses of the Elephant and Castle. And if that was the only one, it wouldn't be enough. But it can also be a remarkable place, which is really distinct. And in your earlier diagram, you said a place. And if it's a place where people want to be, and if it is a place which is going to be popular for people who have choices about where they can go, and for people who live in the area and it happens to be their local place, then you will have succeeded. To do that, we need to get back to a public realm which is shared. We need to get back to activities which are associated with everyone in society. And I think that's going to be one of the challenges that certainly the London Borough of Southwark is going to give to you, to think about almost recreating the city and thinking about those things which are going to bring people back together and not be embarrassed or shy about what their wealth position is, what their opportunities or what their interests are. And my challenge, which I'll keep putting to you, is that that may not just be the model of the old city, and that in the world of the mobile phones, there you are.
On cue.
On cue. And the connectivity, which is so completely different than what was there before. And whether we like it or not, an increasing disparity of income and a lack of acceptance of that. We need to have different objectives for places like the Elephant Castle.
Great. If I can just say a word, I'm John Previck from Norman's office. Some of the details that we're incorporating at the Elephant, I think, are quite interesting in this context. For example, we're suggesting that we introduce a community intranet where individuals living in social or private housing, it doesn't really matter, can log into and be a part of what is going on in the area generally. So, for example, if you wanted to catch a number 19 bus or whatever, which probably wouldn't go to the Elephant Castle anyway because it goes near towards Battersea, but just think of it some other way, but a number whatever bus, you can log on, look at your site, and actually find out when it will arrive at your bus stop down the road. So things like that, I think, where technology is helping to enforce and help social issues so that individuals can interact into their environment far better, I think is a major step forward here.
No, I thought I...
Yes, and say your name and...
Hi, my name's Jemima Broadbridge. I'm a member of the Spitalfields Market Campaign Group, which is currently fighting to save the market from being redeveloped into offices. Charles Landry wrote in his book, The Creative City, A Toolkit for Urban Innovators, the city is an arena of public space and exchange of ideas, is threatened by recent trends towards privatization of public space. What do you think about this with regard to the case of Spitalfields and the market there? Because I know you worked on the Liffey building originally. And now what's happening is it's being privatised by the city, which is moving very avariciously into the east end of London, and there seems to be nothing that the local people can do to stop it. They haven't been consulted at any stage of the process, and it seems to me there's a real need there for consultation in the process of this type of development, where the local planning authorities actually let the local people down very badly, and it hasn't prepared its plans properly, and we've taken them to the High Court and defeated them once. So what would you suggest then for an area which is inherently very, very poor? It needs a mediating body to act between it and the LDA, possibly.
Well, I think the points that I made about the Elephant and Castle was totally about civic leadership and an awareness of the importance of the balance between the private and public forces. And I think that is the strength of the project, and it is the strength of any project. And I made the point when that image came up, which was a theme that I'd been exploring at a CABE conference a few weeks ago, and that was the important role of the client and the very important political dimension behind any project, and I think it's unfortunate if that doesn't come through in a community. I don't know what advice one can give in those circumstances, other than the importance of rallying support and striving to redress that balance. And I guess it was right at the start of the World Squares, where I was saying the importance of the balancing act, the balance between public, private, civic, ceremony, all those pushes and pulls. I think that particular site in question is brings forward some of the issues which the whole philosophy of a London-wide mayor is about. I mean, the project that I didn't show, but if I had more time I would have done, was the one that Saskia referred to, which was the Barcelona Tower. And there, if there had not been the concept of a mayor, Pasqual Maragall, then you would not have one tower on a mountaintop overlooking a city and strategically placed, and you know, nature and trees. You would have a proliferation of towers. You would have three major towers, God knows how many hundred illegal masts. And there were a lot of powerful interests there, private and public, private companies who wanted their masts, public utilities who wanted it. And it was really the ability for somebody to have the authority, and somebody who had to command the respect to be re-elected. And it was interesting that Maragall was re-elected against a political total turnaround. And he was re-elected despite that, because of his personal popularity and because he was seen to do things that were unpopular with some very powerful elements within the community. And he wasn't courting favor. He could also upset the other side on other occasions. But, and I think the site in question is difficult because it is on a boundary. It's on a boundary between a very rich, kind of powerful engine of the national economy with all the sort of clout and pressures that come in. It's on that demarcation. And in a way, it rather has the potential to create a lack of balance because of that. And I think that it, you know, hopefully, it changes are taking place, which in the longer term will override those problems. It does occur to me that maybe there's a clue there in terms of your, maybe you should phone Ken.
Any other question?
What's your response to that? We have actually spoken to Michael Ward from the LDA, and Ken Livingstone can't do anything about it yet until the plans go back to him at the next stage. But he's in favour of office blocks at the moment, I hear. That's all I hear anyway.
All right, we have a question upstairs.
Hi, yes, I'm Matthew Dard, I'm in the sociology department. You start at the beginning by talking about density.
Where's the voice coming from?
Up here.
Up here.
Ah, you started talking about density. But what about when there's cultural resistance to the notion of density? I mean, your first image was of Sydney and the and the Opera House at the Bridge. But if you'd panned out a bit from that, you would have had miles and miles of quarter acre lots, houses, which were built very much.
Can you try shouting without the microphone? Because
it's okay. You can hear me. Built very much into the national psyche, as it were. You know, and there's many, particularly English-speaking countries, that feel that. There's something culturally built against dense cities. You know, is that something that one can change, and how can you do that?
I mean, for those who didn't hear, I understand the question to be that what about those places where culturally there is a resistance to high densities? The example that you gave was Sydney, and did I want to change it all? And the answer is I don't. You know, the interesting thing about an architect is an architect has absolutely no power to do anything. I can't walk on a site, much as I'd dearly love to, and tell a builder what to do. I don't have that authority. I can't create a building. So I'm not a developer, I'm not a politician. In one sense, I can advocate, I can share experience views, I can say that I think that as a generalization, I think one of the challenges that faces us is equating higher density, preserving vital green spaces. And some of the best environments in the world are low-rise high density, and London is not a bad example of that. And if you take some of the most sought-after high-value areas, a bit like the cities that I instance themselves, they are very high density. But no two places are alike. And Sydney on Australia is was a very valid, very interesting example. It's not a tiny, crowded island. It has a huge amount of space. And a lot of those communities have that luxury and that privilege because they have an incredibly well-coordinated transportation policy. One of the best places to be is Sydney Harbour, and to see all those boats coming in. Those boats are the equivalent of the underground here. And they connect those communities, they provide that quality of life, they nurture that culture, but they're beautifully, incredibly well coordinated. And they link with pedestrian routes, they link with bus routes. In many ways, they support a lot of the pleas that I've been making. But Australia is Australia. It has a huge surfeit of land. I mean, mind-blowing. And yes, I think it would be, but you only have to fly a few hours from there. And boy, if I showed Hong Kong Airport a hub, within less than 4 hours flying time of Hong Kong, you've got more than half the world's population. Very, very different story.
Norman, I'd like to ask you a question, or really just to reflect a little on the sense of how your work relates to history. The Reichstag project obviously is set in an extremely traumatic past. The project that you've done for the British Museum lacks that trauma, and the work takes on a different kind of character in its relation to the past. And I'd just be curious how much those kinds of historical issues come into your designing.
I think in some ways, if you take the Reichstag or the British Museum or some of the smaller projects that informed those projects, like the Royal Academy, for example. It was perhaps a fresher way of looking at the issues of how you bring the old and the new together. And I think that for us, there is only really one long tradition, and that is that at any point in time, that age, that society, has made its imprint in its own way. The materials, the forms, technology has always been stretched, has been pushed, and a lot of the things that we think of as kind of cozy and quaint and historic today, in their time, they were really stretching, really pushing the boundaries. They were really very radical. It's only the passage of time that has given us that mellowed, sort of nostalgic view of them. And so in that sense, those large buildings like the British Museum, the Reichstag, are like the city themselves in microcosm. And the city is built up over different periods of time. And some of those buildings have sustained, some have not sustained, they've not renewed themselves. They've been overtaken by events, they've been replaced. And in a way, the richness, the drama of the cities is a mixture of the planned, the organic, the different points in time, the fact that it is in a continuous state of change. I mean, in that sense, cliche though it is, the only constant is change. I think you should communicate directly with the British Museum and Ken. Thank you.
There is time for one more question. The tradition here is to close at 7:30. Is there another question? Norman, why don't you just make a final something else that you might want to add? perhaps, if I may,
yes.
Addressing some of the more complex issues that were raised, I think, by at least two members of the audience, where the intersection between the city and all it means in architecture can sort of heat up a bit. You, not me. I can say something about it too.
The problem is that I could go on so many different threads, and really in the context of an evening I've tried to be fairly fairly selective. I think that the questions and a lot of the discussion really underline the critical importance of strong leadership in terms of those who have the responsibility for commissioning and following through anything which affects the quality of the environment in which we live, and that impacts on us from the largest overview, the largest scale, down to the smallest element of furniture. In that sense, an open space outside in terms of the furniture that populates that, whether those are signs, kiosks, is like the furniture in our own homes, internal spaces. It affects the quality. And but before you can design the physical infrastructure, you have to design the infrastructure of defining social priorities and making the right decisions and structuring that decision-making process. And that is, there's a very strong political imperative there. It is, in terms of quality, about attitude of mind. It is about setting priorities. And all the things that dominate a newspaper, whether it's the experience of being able to get from one place to another safely in a human, civilized way, whether it is the way in which the individual buildings that serve us, whether they're hospitals, schools, places of work, the way in which those come together, they're all equally important, but they are defined priorities. They don't happen by accident or default.
Can I just make a comment? I want to come back to a question that was raised about how history and the trajectory of a particular site might actually produce an enormously significant architectural intervention. And I think that the case of the Reichstag is perhaps one of the clearest examples that we have, which the public love, the public become witnesses to power. It's an enabling environment. I told you my story. I felt enabled because I was not just alone there with the parliamentarians. There was a public, and that public is enabled by that architecture. Now, this is a case that is going to come up over and over again, I think, you know, next century as well as in this century. And I want to ask the question again that was already partly asked, and that is, do you as an architect who has built all over the world, who has built an enormous variety of constructions, do you feel that there are in fact particular moments when history, a place, and architecture have a very sort of productive marriage? Or is it what you just said now, which seemed to standardize it? It's a question of leadership, it's a question of priorities. Is there an enabling environment for architecture to deliver?
How to solve the problems of the planet in in the last 2 minutes. I think that there certainly are points in time where you can see overlapping patterns of change. And it's quite interesting to hear visitors to London comment about London at this point in time and to see the effect of an accumulated series of changes which has happened in a relatively short period of time. And I think that that has to do, I think that the reasons why, and like many individuals, you know, one's asked by visitors, I mean, why? Why is it like that? And you ponder, and there isn't one sort of straight answer. It has to do with a lot of things. I think it has to do with a tremendous influence from continental Europe, where with increased mobility and travel, we have seen the way in which some of those cities have been really improved in terms of their quality of environment, the quality of urban life, and the revitalization that has happened from new initiatives, new marriages of old and new, and renewal of the, you know, the overloaded word of infrastructure as well as individual projects. We have seen political change. We have seen in that same period the concept of a lottery, the way in which that has bridged the political spectrum, the way in which it has provided a kind of input of funds for public buildings, a new generation of public buildings, without any sort of grand master plan. The accumulated effect of those, I think, has had an extraordinary beneficial transformation. So if I think about this particular point in time, and I think about the time when I started with colleagues dividing the start of a painful start of a practice subsidized by teaching and other activities. It was a very different time. It was a very different scene. You did not have whatever the criticisms that abound in anti-European terms. You didn't have a journal where you could actually look through and see a list of competitions that were open to everybody, not only to participate here in projects with public funds, but right across a whole continent. You didn't have the media interest, the coverage. It would be very difficult to imagine an event like this at that period. So yes, I think some periods are more encouraging than others, and in many respects I think this is an extraordinarily good period.
Thank you very much.
Now I get my drink.